There's one last point that Albert makes. So for those of you who are here, I just mentioning this for the record. And those of you who aren't, I still have 3 minutes until I'm supposed to start, so you can just turn off, you know, what fade out. How's that? You have the color tester and the hardness tester, right? You go through the color tester, tells you the color, go back through, always stays the same, same with the hardness tester. And then you have the contraption with mirrors. Now, what he proved last night was that when the thing, when a white electron goes through the mirror contraption, so there's no way to describe what it does. It doesn't come out hard, doesn't come out soft, doesn't go both ways, doesn't go neither way. There's nothing to talk about. But then you can push the idea one step further. Okay, it doesn't go both. It doesn't go hard, doesn't go soft, doesn't go both, doesn't go neither. What is it? Is it hard? Is it soft? What is it? Forget about what it does in the tester. But what is it in and of itself? It goes in white, it comes out white, 100% white, second time round. And it goes through the contraption, it doesn't go anyway. Well, but the contraption is built out of a hardness tester. So, since we know how hardness testers work, and we can test them over and over again, and we can make sure that they're stable and accurate, if the thing goes into the contraption with mirrors and doesn't come out the H slot, then it can't be hard. Because if it were hard, it would definitely come out the H slot. And if it were soft, it would come out the S slot. Because the thing is built out of a hardness tester. That's all it is. So once we've proved by the statistics that it doesn't come out the H slot and it doesn't come out the S slot, what we proved is that the thing isn't hard and the thing isn't soft. It doesn't have either property. And this is where Heisenberg comes in. And this has nothing to do with disturbing the electron. This is one of the other big mistakes that everybody makes. It's only because you're poking it around that it changes. It has nothing to do with disturbing the electron or looking at the electron. We're running them through and testing them afterwards only. And because of the results, it's impossible to say how it gets through. But we know something, that if it were hard, it would come out the H slot. Then if it were soft, it would come out the S slot. So not only have we no way to describe its path through the contraption, but as a result of being unable to describe its path through the contraction, we have to conclude that it's wrong to say that it's hard, it's wrong to say that it's soft. Even though electrons are either hard or soft. But you can't say this was hard, you can't say it's soft, and it has nothing to do with disturbing it, poking it, interacting with it. It has to do with what it is when its color is determined. It starts out white, and it ends up white, it's white 100% of the time, then it is neither hard nor soft. That's the ultimate in fuzz. We're not checking its hardness, so it hasn't got a hardness. It only has a hardness when you're checking. When you're not checking, it doesn't have a hardness. So it has nothing to do with ignorance. I mean, all this Albert says in the chapter. Nothing to do with ignorance. It's not that I don't know whether it's hard or soft. It's not even that I can't know whether it's hard or soft. It is that it isn't hard or soft. It doesn't have a determinate nature, reality, until you test. And if you test it white, and you preserve it white, then the hardness just disappears. Just disappears. And that's the cat behind the sofa. When you're not looking, it turns into blue-green foam. Okay.
What else is for that? Remember last night, that's what's all. Fine. We are part one, chapter four. And we did seven.
And eight.
Up to nine. Now, 9 introduces the idea of the study of Torah. He has a long, important, complicated chapter on this in the fourth part. At the rate that we are going, we'll reach the fourth part in June. But we aren't going to keep going until June, so I don't know if we're going to get to the fourth part. So I'll just give you some of the basic ideas here. If you ever learn Mishnah or Gemara, you will find an issue that comes up over and over again
Which is more important, more valuable? Study of Torah or fulfillment of the commandments? Learning or practice? Talmud or Maisa? Shnais talk about it. He whose knowledge is greater than his deeds, he whose deeds are greater than his knowledge. The Gemara in Kiddushin asks which is greater and has a discussion, a debate. Same thing is reflected in the end of the first chapter of Bava Kamma. I think it would be worthwhile to ask what the question is. How the question got formulated. What the background of the question is. We're setting up study of Torah against fulfillment of the commandments. Isn't the study of Torah also one of the commandments? Sure it is. So what you're really doing is, you got 613, you're picking out one, Q, put it on the side, and asking, is this, which is more important, this one or all the rest? And why would you do that? And how would you pick it? And how come nobody does it for any other commandment? No one asks, which is more important, love of God or all the rest? Or awe of God or all the rest? Or sanctifying God's name or all the rest? Or Shabbos or all the rest? Such a question never arises. It's only study versus practice. Why? Why do that? What's the motivation for it? Now, when you study the chapter in the fourth part, it talks about the study of Torah in detail, and here it just gives a little hint to it. There is a Kabbalistic understanding of what the study of Torah does versus what the performance of other mitzvot does, which makes it reasonable to set up this question and ask which is more important. Without the Kabbalistic understanding, I've never heard an explanation of why the question is reasonable. Well, the question is reasonable. What motivates the question? Who cares? Why pick this one out? My guess is that here the rabbis are sort of letting you in on a secret without telling you the secret. They're setting up this opposition, and they're expecting an intelligent, well-informed reader to say, gosh, what's behind this? And to realize that there's nothing on the page and there's nothing out in the open that motivates the question in the first place. They do this often. They say things that on the surface really aren't well motivated as a kind of prod to the students to realize that there must be something hiding. If it isn't that, I don't know how to explain the question without, on the surface. At any rate, this is roughly the idea. This is what he hints at here, what he says in more detail in part 4. He says, God created a certain shefa. Maybe the best word for shefa in English is energy. It is a flow of divinity into the world. Flow of divine energy. I mean, all these things are subtly different, but I'm not going to make anything out of the difference.
Transcendental forces?
The word shef, I think, is more general. The transcendental forces are a particular level of things that he created to carry the shef into the world. The shef just means some push from divinity into the world. Now, there are lots of them. Lots of them, and they're available in a variety of different ways. One of them is the highest. The highest means that it is the most closely associated with God Himself. Others are more derivative. Others are more nature of means rather than ends. There's one that is the highest. Now, step one is He created the Shefa. Step two is He created the Torah. Step three is He attached the Shefa to the Torah. It's a three-step process. So that when a person learns Torah, it is possible, not necessary, but possible, it's possible that he can interact with that highest Shefa and bring that highest Shefa into the world for his benefit and for the benefit of the world as a whole. Why does he say it that way? Why does he say it's a three-step process? First he creates the Shefa, then he creates the Torah, and then he attaches them. Why not just make the Torah with the Shefa? Because interacting with the Torah does not guarantee that you will reach the Shefa. The relationship between the Torah and the Shefa is an external relationship, not an internal relationship. There's a connector between the two, but the connector has certain conditions to activate it. If the Shefa were internal to the Torah, then any interaction with the Torah would automatically be an interaction with that higher Shefa. But that's not true. Certain conditions have to be fulfilled. In particular, there are two preconditions. One is awe of God. As we said yesterday, we were talking about love and awe. A person who learns Torah without awe of God will have no connection to that highest Shefa, that highest energy at all. Secondly, there has to be a certain level of mitzvah performance. Not perfect. A person doesn't have to be perfect. Probably no one is perfect. But there has to be a certain level of mitzvah performance to qualify the person to interact with that highest chef. Without the combination of those two conditions, he says, the study of Torah can be like the study of chemistry or history or any other science. It's interesting material. And it is complicated and challenging intellectually in various ways, and you can invent new theories and so on and so on. It will have absolutely no spiritual significance. Well, absolutely. It will have no spiritual significance vis-a-vis that highest chef. This is how professors of Talmud, who are not religious at all, can study the Talmud their whole lives and fail to understand it and write misinformed papers about it and go to conferences about it, and it has no spiritual effect on them whatsoever. And I wasn't joking about the misunderstanding. Because they don't fulfill either of the conditions. They have no awe of God, and they have no standard of mitzvah performance. So, they're just not going to interact with that highest energy. Then he says, however, there is something which is much more essential to the Torah, I would say almost internal, what the Talmud calls Hama'or Shabbat, the light that's in it. Such a person could be affected by the light that's in it. It could have some effect in it. The highest energy he's disconnected from, because that's there with the connecting rod, and the connecting rod excludes it. But this is something that's internal. That could have an effect. He might, against his will, from time to time, have certain inspirations. Maybe I really ought to do better with my life. Maybe I really ought to think about my Jewish identity. Maybe. And he might squash them down. But a person who learns Torah in order to make fun of it, in order to destroy it, even the light that's in it won't affect him. He'll be totally disaffected. And that, too, is not an exaggeration. We had a student here. She came to a colleague of mine. She was studying at the HUC here in the city. And she told him that she elected to take a Talmud course. They don't have to study Talmud to become a reformed rabbi, but she elected to do so. And the professor in the first meeting said, I have chosen the tractate Sukkah because Sukkah illustrates just how silly the Talmud is. And then he proceeded to give his 14-week, three times a week course, in which he demonstrated how silly the Talmud is. That's not very surprising. I could do it for physics. I can do it for mathematics. If you just give me 3 50-minute sessions a week for 14 weeks, I can show you dozens and dozens of cases from mathematics and physics will leave you the impression that they are very dumb, silly disciplines. Because the contact is trivial. At any rate, someone who studies the Torah with that kind of mental set to make fun of it or to despise it and to call it into disrepute, so he won't even be affected by the light that's in it. The bottom line is, and this is a theme that comes up over and over again, the real meaning of a mitzvah is determined by what's hidden. Does the mitzvah have a psychological effect on the person who does it? Yes. Does the mitzvah have an effect on the way society is organized? Yes. Can a mitzvah affect the economics of society, distribution of wealth, efficiency? Yes. Is that the essential impact of the mitzvah? No. Because that treats the mitzvah as a means, as a strategy to make more money, to be more productive in science and in the arts, to lower your hypertension, to improve your marriage, to make sure that, try to ensure world peace. The Torah is not designed as an instrument to improve your enjoyment of life while you're alive. This whole world and your life is designed to use the Torah to perfect the whole of creation, and the essential part of creation is not what you see. The essential part of creation is the spiritual underpinnings. So, looking at the psychological effect and the sociological effect and the economic effect is putting things exactly backwards. What you want to do is look at psychology, sociology, and economics as tools for achieving the spiritual effect. And here he's giving us an outline of the spiritual effect. Now, I just want to make a comparison. So now, this highest shefa, this highest energy that the Torah makes available, embraces the whole of creation. Because the Torah is the blueprint of the entire creation. Everything in the creation has its locus, its origination, reflected somewhere in Torah. So a person who learns Torah has access spiritually to the whole of the creation. A person who masters the whole of Torah is a person who is bringing that energy which represents the highest divine connection to the whole of creation, into the whole of creation. Therefore, he says, very interesting practical application, a person should devote at least some time to every section of Torah. A person should not be wholly a specialist. Here you could apply the old Greek motto, the old Greek adage. A person should strive to know something about everything and everything about something. Which I think is reasonably good educational policy, and here it applies directly. You should try to know something about everything, get a broad enough acquaintance with subjects in the world as you can. And you should try to know everything about something. You should specialize in one thing and try to get to the bottom of it. That gives you a balanced education. Now here he says, at the very least, you should have some acquaintance with every area of Torah so that you can participate in applying that energy to the whole of creation. Yes, people, by their own character, by their own personality, will naturally gravitate to one form of Torah learning or more, or another more than others. Some people like Talmudic studies, some people like practical law, some people like Tanakh, or respond to literature or philosophical ideas. But to be totally ignorant to the other, no, that's not appropriate. A person should have his fingers in all the compartments. Now, as against that, each other particular mitzvah is addressed to a particular slice of the creation. No other mitzvah has access to an energy that embraces the whole thing. So here you have already a distinction between Talmud Torah on the one hand and all the other mitzvahs on the other hand, which make them categorically different, and which could then raise a question in one's mind, which one is more important? Where does the effort do the most for the world? Dealing with Talmud Torah, which embraces the whole, or dealing with particular mitzvahs, which are directed to particular slices of creation. Of course, each mitzvah that's directed to a particular slice of creation does something for that slice that Talmud Torah cannot do. So is the piecemeal depth the idea? Or is the universal application of this highest general energy the idea? Which one is more important? Which one is more valuable? That question you can only hear. That question can be motivated, and you would want to know the answer, so as to know how to distribute your efforts. If you don't say that, it's very difficult to understand the question. That's roughly what's going on in Talmud Torah. Your question.
You mentioned about people that, not the people that learn for the sake of mocking it, but people that might learn Talmud and you said they'd misunderstand it. Is it possible you could elaborate on what you mean by it?
Well, I don't say that this is necessarily true, almost, but in my experience, it is extremely, extremely common. I'll give you just two or three examples as to what we're talking about. I was at the University of Toronto about 6 years ago. I met a fellow. The fellow was a junior, majoring in Jewish studies. He had started out in biology, but then he switched. And he said to me that the reasoning of the Talmud is not really very tight, not very, really perfectly logical. I said, really? Could you give me an example? And he said, sure. He says, he's studying the Tractate Kiddushin Yerushalmi, not the Babylonian Talmud, but the Jerusalem Talmud. Sorry, specialist business. And he's studying with his professor, who's tutoring him, sort of doing it one-on-one. And he happened to have a copy of the Tractate in front of him, and he said, oh, sure. So I took it out. I said, where's the problem? He showed me the page that I saw. Now, I have not read that Tractate, certainly not in Yerushalmi. I've written about it several times, but not in Yerushalmi. But on the page, there is a commentary called the Pnei Moshe, who, sort of like Rashi in our Gemaras, explains. So I read the lines of the Talmud, and I read the Pnei Moshe, and I translate it for him, and I explain how the logic goes. I can't see any problem. So I read the whole thing, and I say to him, tell me, where's the problem? Sounds to me like it goes through fine. He said, oh, you know, the way you explained it, it does go through fine. Oh. Now, I'm sight reading. First time through. So I said, well, you mean you and your professor couldn't figure this out? He said, no, we got stuck here, we got stuck here, you know, it just didn't seem to go. He said, well, who's your professor? He says, well, my professor recently received her PhD in Talmud from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. She received her PhD in Talmud, and she couldn't read the commentary on the page. Now, I'm not exaggerating if I tell you that in our circles, in the Haredi circles of the world, my Talmudic skills are regarded as average. Okay, because I've had some philosophical, maybe a little above the average. There are tens of thousands of people who understand the Talmud just as well as I, and could have sight-read that piece of Gemara just as easily as I. What's going on here? She's a professor with a PhD, and she isn't as good as tens of thousands of ordinary people who are businessmen and dentists and doctors and truck drivers and who knows what. What's the standard here? And her specialty is feminism in the Talmud. Can you imagine what she's going to discover? Can you imagine what's the paper she's going to write? Can you imagine what conferences she's going to deliver? When she can't read the commentary on the page. You know that Maimonides wrote the Guide of the Perplexed. The translation that is used most today is a translation by Shlomo Pinas at the Hebrew University, put out by University of Chicago Press 25 years ago. The introduction to that translation was written by a fellow named Leo Strauss. The introduction is 90 pages long. That's a pretty big vote of confidence in a scholar to write a 90-page introduction to the Guide of the Perplexed. He taught it, he says in the introduction, he taught it every year for 19 years, and you know, he lives it, eats it, sleeps it, like it's him, it's like the world. Okay. On pages 2 and 3 of his introduction, he says, Maimonides was prepared to break Jewish law when it suited him. This is a view that's widespread in academia. Maimonides was a conservative rabbi. You know? He kept up his appearances for the frumis, you know, to keep them off guard. But really, really, when he felt like it, he did what he pleased. And he has two proofs of it. Proof number one. He says that everyone knows it is forbidden to investigate the reasons of the commandments. And yet, 1/6 of the guide is an explanation of reasons for the commandments. So you see that Maimonides just violated the law. Now, when he says everybody knows it's forbidden to examine the reasons of the commandments, there are no footnotes. This is the scholar, the professor. No footnotes. So you wonder, everybody knows? Well, it's a matter of fact. This text, this subject is discussed in a famous Talmud in Tractate Brachos. And Maimonides, in his legal work, the Mishneh Torah, which he wrote to keep the rabbis happy, says twice that it is appropriate for every Jew to investigate the reasons for the commandments. So, what happened? Strauss just made it up. He made it up. Maybe he heard it, misunderstood it. He made it up. There is no such prohibition. That's point number one. Then he says, Maimonides writes in the guide that the whole purpose of the Torah is to destroy idol worship. Which is true. Maimonides does write that. Yet, says Strauss, Maimonides tells us that he read every book on idol worship that he could find. Which is true. Maimonides does say that. Therefore, says Strauss, you see that he broke the law. Let's go slowly now. Let's try that again. Come on, I'm only in third grade. The purpose of the Torah is to destroy idol worship. Okay, got it? That's its purpose. Therefore, if you read a book on idol worship, you're breaking the Torah. Really? How does that follow? But what's the connection supposed to be? As a matter of fact, the Talmud, of course, these guys are going to read the Talmud, you know, that's just legal stuff. But the Talmud discusses this, and the verse says, don't learn the ways of the idol worshippers to do as they do. And the Talmud says, don't learn to do, but you can learn to understand. And indeed, to be a member of Sanhedrin, you had to know the ways of idol worship, because otherwise, if you didn't, how could you try a case of idol worship? Huh? If you don't know what it is. So it's just made up. It's just made up. A logic that's worthy of an 8-year-old, when you get to your 9 years of age, you can see already that it's not there. This is the great Leo Strauss. Now, I've asked people about this. Give me a break. When I was in graduate school, I had friends who were in graduate school in Jewish studies at Harvard. And I read an essay by a fellow named Ginsburg. Ginsburg says, in the Talmud, we're told that a Jew should not rent an ox to a non-Jew in the land of Israel. A man rule like that. And I said, why not? Because the Jew trained the ox to work. And he'll give it to the goy. The goy will you work the ox on Shabbos. So the Jew is contributing to the ox work on Shabbos. Shouldn't do that. Shabbos prohibition. Says this fellow Ginsburg, either the rabbis have forgotten the true reason, or they're lying. That's what it says. They either forgot the true reason or they're lying. The true reason is this. He who has the use of an ox can plow land. He who can plow the land can own the land. Ownership of land gives you power. So this was an economic measure to protect the power of the Jews in the land of Israel so that non-Jews wouldn't be able to have power. It's really all economic. So when they say that it's Shabbos, that's baloney. That's what the inverse says. So I went to my friends at Harvard and I said, listen, we know that the rabbis took very, very strict, stringent measures with respect to Shabbos. When Rosh Hashanah comes out on Shabbos, the whole of the Jewish people gives up the mitzvah of shofar for that year. Second day is only rabbinic. They give up the mitzvah of shofar that year because maybe someone will forget that it's Shabbos, and maybe he'll live in a city without an Erev, and maybe he'll carry it through the street. So because some extremely small minority of people might make a mistake in what they're doing, we give up the mitzvah the whole year. So I said, you see that the rabbis were very extreme about Shabbos. How does Ginsburg know that in renting the animal, Shabbos isn't the real reason? You know what he said to me? Of course, you don't understand. Ginsburg was a communist. And as a communist, he had to find economic explanations for everything. Communists believe that economics and only economics explains everything. Of course, this paper is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's stupid. Nobody pays attention to that. But he wrote an introduction to the Yerushalmi that's very valuable. This is the standard academic scholarship. These are the academics. Later people said, it's stupid. He was enamored of communism. So he said the rabbis either forgot are liars because he's trying to put Marx into the Talmud. And Mimela, I have instance after instance. Now, you know already that I didn't start out from. And I spent my time, when I was investigating, I spent a period of time when I was involved in the conservative movement. How many examples do you have like this before you begin to say, these guys aren't serious? They really aren't serious. Moshe Eisenman, whom I've mentioned a number of times because of his book, Living Jewish Law, tells me that when he was at Harvard, a guy came to read a paper, and the thesis of the paper was to explain why Jewish slaves are freed in the sabbatical year. So Meisner would let him go halfway into the paper, and then he raised his hand and said, excuse me, could you show me where in the Torah it says that slaves are freed in the 70th, in the sabbatical year? It took the guy a while to find the verses altogether. We finally find them. What it says there is, if you bind a Jewish slave, he works 6 years, and the seventh year he goes free. That's 7 years from when you bought him. It has nothing to do with the sabbatical year. The guy wrote a paper and came to present it at Harvard based on a simple mistake. What are we talking about? So now, when I was an undergraduate, I had a professor who said, "Vayetze Yitzchak lasuach basadeh." Isaac went out lasuach in the field. What does lasuach mean? Well, this was the 60s. And in the 60s, they were discovering and deciphering Akkadian and Ugaritic, other ancient Near Eastern languages. And all the rage was to find parallel forms in those languages and use them to interpret what it says in the Torah. Good. So he said to us, I forget if it was Akkadian or Ugaritic, but it doesn't really matter. He said, what we now know is, the verse says, Isaac went out to urinate in the field. Because lasuach in one of those languages means to urinate. Now listen, boys and girls. The Tanakh is 1,000 pages long. Not once in 1,000 pages do you have such a description or such a remark. Nowhere. The only thing that's not an exception is when King Saul, when David catches King Saul in a cave all by himself. So the Tanakh has to explain, how is the king all by himself? It's just because he went to eliminate. But other than that, there's no description of this activity in 1,000 pages of Tanakh. Furthermore, the verb is a Hebrew verb. There are cognates of that verb in the Tanakh itself. Why would you go to another language to find the verb which makes this into a description, which this piece of literature never discusses, when in the very same piece of literature you have a word where it means to converse? Does that sound logical to you? Does it sound logical to me? So after, 60 or 70 of these, I began to get tired of it. The Book of Ruth is feminist lobbying for fairness in feminist employment practices. How the boys treat her in the field, and what a boss does, and so on and so on. It's really 20th century. Doesn't that make it contemporary? Doesn't it make it relevant? Yeah, but it makes it false, because it wasn't written in Chicago in 1978. But this is, that's why I said that they misunderstand it, and they misapply it, and they're often fancy. Yeah.
Even someone like Yankov Neusner.
Please. If you want material on Neusner, I have it in what I wrote. I'll send you an email of 7 or 8 pages on Neusner stuff. He's great at fantasy.
For example.
Okay. he claims that decorating synagogues with figures, whether it's pictures or it's even three-dimensional figures, is imported from Greece and from certain pagan rites, and it shows that Judaism incorporated Greek elements. So I just can't account for the fact that in the tabernacle we had statues, the statues of the Kruvin, the angels, and the divider between the Holy of Holies and the Holy was a gigantic tapestry with eagles woven into it and other figures woven into it. Solomon built more angels, golden angels, and put them as elements in his large, enlarged temple. He had four statues of bulls holding a circular basin in which water was placed. Here you have statues, and here you have pictures. They're all traditional in Jewish sources. And they're not criticized. People say Solomon broke the Torah and did it. Well, how he did it? No, but it's there. It's there. So why would you say it's Greek? I don't get it. These guys are just not serious.
I was referring to the comparison between Solomon and Babylon. It's the whole thing, philosophy of the Talmud.
Well, I can only tell you, I haven't studied that, but he had a teacher at Columbia. I think his name was Smith, if I'm not mistaken, non-Jew, who was his teacher. And there's a famous incident that took place. They were at a conference, and Smith got up in front of the whole group and held a copy of Neusner's book and said, "This book is junk." And he threw it on the floor in front of everybody. And Neusner was classy enough to respond that Smith was my teacher and is my teacher and will be my teacher. It was a classy response. But the book was thrown on the floor. Right. So, okay. I think that's enough. That is more than enough. Okay, so that's just a little insight into the study of Torah. By the way, one last thing he says, which it may be hard to relate to, but I'm just telling you that's a fact. We talk about study of Torah. Study of Torah is on a variety of different levels. He includes, maybe the word study isn't quite right now, maybe I should just say interacting with the Torah. He includes reading the written Torah, which for him is the whole Tanakh, reading the written Torah, pronouncing the words without any understanding at all, without any comprehension, just mouthing the syllables, with awe of God, and with reasonable mitzvah compliance. Mouthing the syllables is enough to interact with that higher energy. Of course, the interaction is minimal. The interaction is not deep, not powerful. But this shows you that the gesture here is not a Greek gesture. You know, we're not glorifying the mind. We're not glorifying the mind. The mind is a tool of achieving spirituality, just as the arms and legs are, and just as your pocketbook is, and your house, and your car. All of them are tools of achieving spirituality, and there are ways to achieve it by interacting with the Torah that are not that do not involve the mental understanding. Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand this energy that's going down that God gives that gives like economic booms. I mean, that gives like what does it do when you strengthen it and whatever you do.
It wouldn't be directly linked to economics.
I'm saying it has an effect on worldly things. Is that what it does?
Well, if I am part of the world and it strengthens my focus, it strengthens my orientation, it strengthens my will, it strengthens my perception and sensitivity, then it's going to have an effect on how I interact with the world altogether. You know, very interesting. In the Gemara, in Kiddushin says, which is greater, study or practice? So, Rabbi Akiva said, I think, study. Rabbi Tarfon said, practice. And then it says, the assembled company said, listen carefully. Okay, you've been sleeping up to now. Now it's your turn. You have to think. Study is greater because study leads to practice. What? Which is greater, study or practice? Study is greater because study leads to practice. What? What does that mean?
You're saying practice is greater.
I mean, but then why say study is greater? Right? I ask you, which is better, A or B? See, A is better because A leads to B.
It's better to have B, which you can't get without A.
Oh, you're close. But I mean, just look, first of all, that the bold statement of the Talmud is very peculiar. You tell me A is better, and the reason it's better is because it gets me to B? That's ridiculous. So Rashi says, three words. Talmud is better because it leads to practice. V'nimtza shnehem b'yado. And now he's got both. Which means, the Talmud started by asking a question of principle. If I have each one in isolation, which is better? The assembled company declined to answer that question. They declined to answer that question. They answered a different question. Practically, which one should I invest in? And their insight was, to tell you what to do practically, I don't have to answer the theoretical question. Because if you invest in study, you'll come to fulfill, and you'll have both. So why bother investigating which is more important than isolation? This way you can have both. Wouldn't you do that if it was a car and a boat? Which is better to have, the car or the boat? Listen, if you buy the car, you get the boat for free. You say, well, then of course. When I bought to buy the boat, that would be dumb. Buy the car and get the boat for free, and you get both. Why do I have to worry now which is better? So Rashi is saying that the assembled company avoided the question. And indeed, the question comes back in the end of the first chapter of Bava Kamma, which I told you, and over there, there's a controversy how to understand it. But this is what the Talmud is saying. The Talmud is saying that the effect of study on practice is so profound that you should invest heavily in study. That will bring you to practice and you'll end up with both. Okay. Now, one other thing here. Another thing that's very, very widely misunderstood. This is paragraph 10. We're almost finished. Maybe we'll finish the chapter 10. Every state in which the individual exists, whether it's darkness or light, is the result either of the presence or absence of God's light. Presence or absence. If something is illuminated by God's presence, its purity and perfection are increased according to the degree of illumination. The opposite is true when its light is concealed. And here you have the idea, which you often hear, that evil is just the absence of good. Either you have good or you don't have good. Evil isn't another positive thing in its own right. Either evil is just the absence of good. Now, I'll tell you what bothers me in that statement. What bothers me in that statement is the word just. It's as if to say, listen, don't get worried. Don't get worried. Don't be upset. After all, what is evil? Evil is just, all it is the absence of good. You know, that, yeah, no, I'm saying it. I'm saying this is what you hear people say. Right? As if to say, that's not so terrible. You know, it's just the absence of good. That's not something. Now, let me ask you. A person is shot through the heart. Will he die? Yes. The bullet through the heart is going to very much disrupt the functioning of his body. You wanted to ask a question. I've kept you down all this time. Did you get to ask it? No. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay, fine. I just can't remember. All right? It's a positive disruption of his body's functioning. He's going to die. Now, let's suppose we put a plastic bag over his head. All I'm doing is depriving him of air. See? I'm just depriving. I'm not forcing on him a positive evil. I'm just depriving him of the good. Will he die? Yes. He'll be just as dead. Right? So, I don't get it. Seems to me that the absence of good can be very, very damaging. You know, it can be deadly. So, to say that evil is the absence of good is not to minimize it. It's not to give you, you know, a spoonful of honey to take it down with and make it not taste so bad. The absence of good can be just as devastating as whatever you call positive evil. Only, metaphysically, it makes a difference. It makes a difference in God's attitude. It makes a difference in their status. It makes a difference between means and ends. But it doesn't mean that the evil is less painful or less destructive or less worrisome. That concept that it's only just the absence of good, I think that's extremely, extremely misleading. Yeah.
Does that mean that people are ultimately good?
Why would it mean that?
because evil is only the absence. Evil is only the absence of good. Meaning you have good, and as you go along, you can cover the good up, and you become bad and evil. Which means that you're just good.
Okay. Let me try it again. Maybe another misunderstanding here, which I wasn't aware of. If we're told that evil is the absence of good, does that mean that evil isn't real?
Evil is real.
Sure it is. The good can be present, but the good can be absent. And when the good is absent, that's evil.
But the good is the beginning.
Why?
Not necessarily. You can just be void of good, and then you're full of
evil.
Because
you have
more good.
To have evil, you have to cover up the good.
Well,
you
just absent
is the first
place. Absent, yeah. Right. They just don't put it in.
You have darkness, you got to cover up the light, you just...
Okay, you're sort of right, but I think you're pushing the point too far. Imagine an agent who's wholly good and doesn't give all of himself. Is that covering it up? It's not as if it's already there and covered up, it never comes in. He just holds it back. That's Timson.
Yeah. I have a question how this relates to commandments and averos. When you do a commandment, right, you are perfecting yourself and making and acquiring good. When you don't do a commandment, you're not acquiring good. And when you do an avera, a transgression, what do you get? It sounds like if evil is only not acquiring good, it sounds like when you do a transgression, you can't acquire bad. It's just if you're not getting good, you've already done the transgression.
Evacuating?
No, okay, good. It's a good question. The answer is that the good is coming from God. So when a person does a transgression, he's cutting himself off from the flow. He's putting up a barrier to the flow. If he does something that's neither a mitzvah nor a transgression, so he's not aiding the flow, and he's not inhibiting the flow.
But still, that's evil.
Why is that?
Because he could have gotten more good.
Well, now you switch definitions. It's not the best thing he could have done, correct. He had something better he could have done. But the state that he's in of being a state of good or a state of evil depends upon how much of the flow from God he's receiving. And you asked, how does the action affect that flow? You made it sound as if either the action promotes it, and if it doesn't promote it, then there's an absence, because the absence is already evil. So I say, no, an action can have one of three effects on the flow. It can promote the flow, it can decrease the flow, or it can have no effect on the flow.
Okay, but if you take it sort of towards specific, not so. If you look at just the effect on the person, let's say he keeps getting 100 flow,
yeah.
And then if he does a mitzvah, he'll get 120,
right.
And if he does an avera, he'll get 80.
That's right.
So if he has the choice whether to do the mitzvah or not do the mitzvah, but not do an avera,
yeah.
Then for that 20 whatever flow,
it stays in heaven.
But that's evil because we said that.
The absence of that 20%.
No. Then you can talk about relative evil. In other words, he didn't get as much good as he could have gotten.
Right.
But it doesn't make him more evil than he was because the flow as it stands.
But he has an absence in him.
Why? He
has an absence of the potential he could have gotten.
But that's not an absence. That's an absence of potential. The difference between, as you'll find when you someday have to be responsible for money, you'll discover there's a big difference between losing money you have and failing to make a profit that you could have made. In Hilchos Cholamoy, if you're running a business, if you are in danger of losing money, then you are allowed to do work on Cholamoy. But if you are in danger of losing a profit, you cannot do work on Cholamoy. Economically, they're different. And psychologically, they're different.
I can understand that in money, but it seems like he's saying it works differently.
We'll see why. Yeah.
Over here, when it says when anything is illuminated by God's presence, its purity and perfection are increased according to the degree of this illumination. The opposite is true when His light is concealed. So that seems to be that there's light, and it's being covered over, it's being concealed, and that's what evil is. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Let me check the evil. Yeah. Helem. Good point. Helam really does mean to be concealed. I have to think about it. It's a good point. Very good.